Our third case this morning is United States against Daly, a certified case. Goldman's the appellant. Counsel may proceed.
Chief Judge Efron, judges, may it please the court. I'm Lieutenant Clay Pennell. Captain Cleary and I represent the United States. This court has jurisdiction, as did the Coast Guard Court of Criminal Appeals before. Decisions are not final until reconsideration is complete. The United States complied with Article 62, RCM 905F, and RCM 908 by filing a notice of appeal within 72 hours of denied reconsideration. On the substantive case, the Coast Guard vitiated a large portion of Article 134. Unacceptable relationships, even adulterous or exceptionally egregious ones, can no longer be prosecuted. Your Honors, military personnel are always on notice that wrongful acts to the prejudice of good order and discipline can be prosecuted under 134. A subsequent order subjecting certain of those to Article 92 does not preclude or preempt the rest from Article 134. Your Honors, Coast Guard policy is to prosecute the category of prohibited relationships, but not the categories of personal or romantic relationships. The third or middle category of unacceptable relationships has no policy to prosecute or not to prosecute, but is normally resolved administratively.
Isn't that a policy?
It's a policy of how it's normally resolved. Yes, sir.
Wait a minute. It's a policy or it's not a policy? It's a statement as to the normal disposition of these cases, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and this case falls within that category?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, then why is it not a policy as to the disposition of cases of this nature?
Your Honor, of the four categories, the other three specifically state whether prosecution will occur or not. In this category, it says it's normally resolved administratively. So that is the Coast Guard policy. The policy, however, isn't specific as to whether or not prosecution generally.
It sounds pretty specific to me. It will normally be disposed of in A. That leaves you wiggle room for B, I suppose, as a matter of logic. But is that not a policy stating that it will normally be disposed of as A?
Your Honor,
maybe we're fencing about terminology here, but it seems to go to the core of the case.
Yes, Your Honor, there is the policy that it is normally resolved administratively. And as you point out, Your Honor, there's a logical upward bound to normally administrative. Logically unacceptable misconduct that would be abnormally egregious would be the type of misconduct that would go beyond that normal.
Okay, doesn't the personnel manual state that it's a punitive reg?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah, it purports to be a punitive reg.
Yes, sir.
Okay, when you take a reg that states explicitly that it's a punitive reg, and you state in the context of a punitive reg that normally this category of case will be dealt with outside of the court-martial process, isn't that notice to the accused?
Your Honor, it's one element of notice and an important element of it. But notice would be an evidentiary question where there would be the service regs, service custom, and others would be considered.
Well, what happens when reg and custom collide? Or do we have a collision here? Are you citing custom now?
No, Your Honor. There's no collision in this case. The policy, the 8H specifically sets this up as an unacceptable relationship, or in this
Well, we're not talking about whether it's acceptable. We're talking about what you do with it. And it says it's normally disposed of administratively in the context of a reg that states on its face that it's punitive.
Yes, Your Honor, that's exactly the words that are stated, but in terms of the question of what is the service custom, the service custom is inconsistent with the regs, the service custom is that this is unacceptable behavior, not...
I see what you're saying. You're saying that the service custom is that it's unacceptable behavior, but not the service custom doesn't go to disposition.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Well, we heard the government arguing earlier this morning that a statute that describes a whole series of behavior as unacceptable doesn't make it criminal. So why does this regulation make these activities criminal as a matter of custom?
Your Honor, this regulation itself isn't what makes it criminal. Article 134 sets forth the elements of an offense, wrongful act to the prejudice of good order and discipline.
Right, but how do you...
Where's the custom found that then gives you notice under 134 that this relationship is criminal?
Yes, Your Honor, the custom...
If not in this regulation.
The custom comes from the training that members receive. It comes from how members act. It becomes a question of fact.
And where is that documented in this record?
Well, Your Honor, this record is very narrow, precisely because there was never an evidentiary hearing. That goes precisely to why we're here today.
So which puts you back into the jurisdictional argument. What order or ruling are you seeking certification or review on?
Your Honor, we're seeking certification on the question on whether or not, as I understand it, the question of jurisdiction that the court ordered was whether or not...
You're arguing that you complied with the 72-hour rule, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And you complied with it with respect to which rule or order?
Your Honor, by filing the notice of appeal within 72 hours of the denied reconsideration, we complied with the 72-hour notice of appeal.
Any ruling or order, or just for the ruling or order dealing with the motion for reconsideration?
Well, Your Honor, this would be for the... There was no final decision until reconsideration was complete. So the motion for reconsideration was a substantive motion that goes to...
So your argument in your brief was that you dealt with the 72 hours by saying you were appealing the motion for reconsideration, but now you're dealing with the whole lot by saying there was nothing to appeal until it was final.
Well, Your Honor, it becomes something of a very difficult distinction because the motion for reconsideration was substantive, so it's difficult to unpack exactly theologically where that line.
Well, what you're saying, I think, that the government can basically, you've got a 72-hour statutory limit, and you're saying, and when did the government do something?
Your Honor, the government filed notice of appeal 72 hours after.
No. When after the initial decision did the government do anything?
Your Honor, the government filed a motion for reconsideration 12 days.
12 days. Okay, you got a statute that says 72 hours. The government piddled around for 12 days and now comes in and says, oh, it doesn't matter. What if the government had piddled around for 6 months?
Well, Your Honor, there's an outward bound set up by 905F, which is before authentication. In this case, authentication took place well before that 6 months hypothetical.
Well, but we just heard a case today where authentication was, shall we say, substantially delayed. In a case like that, can the government piddle around until authentication and then say, well, you know, we're going to ask you to reconsider?
Well, Your Honor, the rules as...
We're dealing with jurisdiction here.
Yes, sir. As the rules are set forth now by the President and how it interplays with Article 62, yes, that is the reading. Now, in this case, the government acted in good faith. If the government...
Well, Counsel, where are you getting the good faith test from? I mean, we'll take, for an example, the Supreme Court's rule as to when a petition for certiorari has to be filed. Even in those circumstances where it's not statutory, someone might ask for an extension within the period that they could have filed anything to begin with. But after that time, whether it's good faith, bad faith, or mistake, or whatever, it doesn't matter. So where are you getting the good faith test from in a statutory time limit context?
Your Honor,
why does it matter?
It may not matter. I think the question the judge was asking was whether If the government were piddling around, would there be some way to say that it was unreasonable? We don't have an exact...
No, I'm not asking whether it was unreasonable. I'm not asking about good faith. I'm saying how far can you carry this argument?
Under the rules as they exist until authentication.
Thank you.
So, to be clear...
Yes, sir.
Maybe not be clear. We'll try. The case can take several months to try. At the outset of the case, there's a motion to dismiss a charge on an issue of law, not an issue of fact, and it's granted by the judge. So the case goes to trial. The trial's completed. Findings are entered in that case, and then the record is authenticated. Let's say there are multiple charges, and the particular dismissal only goes to one of those charges. Can a motion to reconsider be filed then months later when the judge is still considering authentication and reopen the findings in the case? Can that be done?
Yes, Your Honor.
If that's the case, then it would seem to me that the 72-hour rule statute is now being overcome by a rule in the manual for courts martial that would allow a government appeal, irrespective of the 72-hour period, months and months later. So my question there is, where does the president have the authority to issue such a rule if we were to interpret it in that fashion in light of Article 36, which says that the president's rules have to be not contrary to or inconsistent with the express words of the UCMJ?
Your Honor, the president's rule in this case is not inconsistent, at least with the plain reading of Article 62. Article 62 is for the ruling or decision, you have 72 hours. And the case law, both in the civilian side and in the Smith case, is that there isn't even a final decision until that reconsideration has taken place. There's nothing to appeal. To seek appeal and reconsideration at the same time would undermine the judicial economy.
Even if we agreed with you that it's the motion for reconsideration that does something, why wouldn't that have to take place within the 72-hour period to have any effect whatsoever? Without having to decide that in this case, you waited 12 days.
Well, Your Honor,
I don't mean you personally. The government waited 12 days. Isn't that squarely at odds both with the 72-hour language in the statute and the purpose behind the 72-hour statute, the 72-hour time limit in the statute?
No, Your Honor. The rule is clear. The president can change the rule if that seems like the appropriate thing to do. In terms of the 72 hours or the 12 days, the government, it's conceivable that if there were different kinds of rules, that might be the case. But in this case, the government complied with the rules as they currently exist. Your Honors, if exceptionally extreme unacceptable relationships fall outside the supposed safe harbor, the military judge would have to look to evidence to determine whether that was the case here. Here, the military judge would have had to find specific facts to determine whether or not the unacceptable relationships were so egregious that Petty Officer Daley could have been on notice. That question of fact is possible in this case, where Appellee was charged with four unacceptable relationships, each of which was unacceptable in at least four different ways. Your Honors, the United States respectfully requests that this Court find that 134 is not robbed from covering egregious unacceptable relationships, and that this case be remanded for further evidentiary hearings.
Thank you, Counsel. Counsel for the defense.
Yes, Your Honor.
Chief Judge and judges of the court, may it please the court. I'm Lieutenant Eric Lobsinger and Lieutenant Commander Cheddar Charn, and I represent the appellee in this case, Bosun's Mate First Class Andrew Daley. Your Honor, I'd first like to begin by answering a question that you asked government counsel, and that is, where does the president have the authority to issue rules that overcome the authority of the statutes in the UCMJ, or is expressed in the UCMJ? And a simple answer to that is there is no authority.
Well, as I understand the government's argument is that they're harmonious, and that is that the 72-hour period isn't triggered until there's a final ruling, so you read the two together.
Your Honor, the UCMJ, Article 62, is incredibly clear that the government has 72 hours. And the 72 hours began after the dismissal by the military judge. And within those 72 hours, the government could have filed perhaps a motion for reconsideration, or could have filed a notice of appeal to the Coast Guard Court.
What if the government was appealing the motion for consideration as its ruling?
If the government is limiting its appeal to just that issue, for example, if the government feels that the denial of reconsideration was an abuse of discretion, then perhaps that would be permitted. Yes, sir, that would fall within the 72 hours, arguably. But that's not the case here. The case here is the government is appealing the entire issue, as government counsel mentioned. He's appealing not only the reconsideration, but also the substantive issues in the case.
Certified Issue 3 fall into the category of appealing the motion for reconsideration?
No, Your Honor. The motion for reconsideration, if the government wished to appeal that, it would simply be a motion, for example, an appeal to the judge's discretion, say an abuse of discretion argument. The 72 hours is really critical here because, as this court outlined in the case recently, U.S. v. Rodriguez, 72 hours of statutory timelines are jurisdictional issues. And in fact, there's jurisdictional significance in the fact that a time limitation is set forth in statute. It's clear that the 72 hours is a statutory rule. Two, statutory time limits for appeals must be strictly adhered to for there to be valid appellate jurisdiction. And three, whatever other precedent might be out there prior to Rodriguez explicitly overruled those other decisions, saying that because Rodriguez applied the Supreme Court's holding in Bowles v. Russell, that statutory time limits are jurisdictional matters. Now, I'd like to point out that this case revolves around Article 62 time limits. And I realize that there was some disagreement in this court about the application of time limits in Article 67 in Rodriguez. Whatever disagreements may have occurred with this court on that particular issue, on Article 67, because of the interpretation of the word may, whether it had a limiting effect or whether it had a permissive effect, that doesn't exist in this case, because Article 62 is unequivocally clear that this is a limiting test, that this is a limiting factor, and this is actually backed up by Rule 908, and also if you look at the analysis of the rules in Appendix 21 of 908. That government appeals are disfavored, and they should not be exercised except in the most judicious and rare exceptions. And for that reason, the time limit is very short. In fact, the 72-hour time limit here is actually the shortest time limit anywhere outlined in the UCMJ. And there's a reason for that. Again, government appeals are disfavored.
Oh. Doesn't that also have something to do with the fact that nothing else can happen in the case until they're done doing that, if they're going to do it?
I'm sorry, ma'am.
The 72 hours isn't just because it's because government appeals are disfavored. It's because if the government says that they're going to take an appeal, nothing else can happen.
Well, yes, ma'am. And at 72 hours, all the government is required to do is file a notice of appeal. The government is not required to file a brief with the Court of Appeals, but just to file a notice of appeal. And in fact, just taking this to the logical extension of the government's argument, if this court reviews the merits of this case, allows the government to push forward on the substantive issues, on the underlying issues of this case, then the 72-hour time limit in Article 62 would in effect be nullified, because all the government would have to do in any case is submit a motion for reconsideration after 72 hours has passed, and then wait for the military judge to make some sort of decision, whether it's a denial, and then appeal from there within 72 hours of that. And that would essentially render Article 62 meaningless. So this is not just a case that is fact specific. I mean, there are some great principles here about preserving the integrity of Article 62 and the 72-hour limit that was created by Congress and is mandated by Congress. Which, as we've already discussed, the government does not have, or the president does not have the authority to overcome rules established by Congress. On the, I'd also like to point out here that it was an issue I believe raised by Judge Ryan on a filing reconsideration request within the statutory deadlines for notice of appeal. And that, again, would arguably preserve jurisdiction. That is, that's far more within the scope and within the spirit of the Article 62. The government counsel raised the issue of, I believe, the U.S. v. Smith case, where that was an Article 67 case. It was an appeal from the Coast Guard Court of Criminal Appeals to this court. And it was a 60-day rule. The government filed, or in that case, it was the accused filed an appeal or filed a motion for reconsideration within those 60 days. And it was after the Coast Guard Court denied that reconsideration that the clock started for the 60 days under Article 67. But again, that's very distinct from this particular case and the facts of this case, because in this case, within the deadline, the government failed to either file a motion for reconsideration or file a notice of appeal. And as Judge Stuckey mentioned, I mean, the government waited 12 days. We're not just talking 73 hours or 74 hours. We're talking 12 days. And so if we allow this sort of appeal to go on, how long is the court willing to wait? 5 months, 6 months, where does it end?
Counsel, I don't want to cut off your argument here. If you'd like to continue on this issue, that's fine. But if you'd like to address the other issue, you may do so now.
Yes, Your Honor. The other issue, should this court still find that that the court wishes to address the merits of the case, this is a very simple matter. Essentially, we're dealing with a Coast Guard regulation outlined by the Coast Guard Personnel Manual. The Coast Guard Personnel Manual outlines what sort of interpersonal relationships are acceptable or prohibited, and outlines two very specific categories. Now, I'd like to highlight the fact that this is an issue that was, one, reviewed by a Coast Guard military judge, and two, was also reviewed afterward by the Coast Guard Court of Criminal Appeals. Two bodies or two courts, two jurisdictions that have expertise on the Coast Guard Personnel Manual. And the Coast Guard Personnel Manual states that there are prohibited and unacceptable relationships and makes those distinctions very clear. Now, the Coast Guard Personnel Manual states certainly that unacceptable relationships are normally handled administratively. But if you read this a little bit closer, if you look at the Coast Guard Personnel Manual, it actually says on unacceptable relationships that unacceptable personal relationships is in the best, or avoiding all those are in the best interest of all concerned, and it lists some ways to remedy these unacceptable personal relationships, including training, counseling, and administrative actions help prevent unacceptable relationships or minimize detrimental effects when unacceptable relationships develop. And then it goes on to say prompt resolution at the lowest level possible is desirable. So when the Coast Guard Personnel Manual says that these things are normally handled administratively, I think what the manual is also saying is that it doesn't necessarily have to be handled administratively. There's also training and counseling and administrative.
Now, that's an argument. Between B, C, and D, you listed one category that's not included, which is romantic relationship. And then it says parentheses, does not involve conduct which violates the UCMJ. And then D violates the UCMJ. And then C is silent. Doesn't that create a continuum of conduct between that which does not violate the UCMJ and that which does violate the UCMJ?
No, Your Honor. What the conduct that violates DUCMJ is specifically stated. It says prohibited relationships.
That's correct. And then romantic relationships specifically indicates that it does not violate DUCMJ. And between the two of them is this other category, which is at issue today, which is unacceptable relationships. Isn't it fair to infer that perhaps that lies somewhere between something that does violate DUCMJ and something that does not violate DUCMJ?
No, Your Honor.
That's not how you would read it.
No, Your Honor, and that's not how the military judge read this, nor is it how the Coast Guard Court of Criminal Appeals read the Coast Guard Personnel Manual.
They did not cite to those parentheticals either, did they?
Yes, Your Honor.
They just ignored those.
Yes, Your Honor. But again, this is an issue in which, as far as prohibited relationships, the Coast Guard Personnel Manual is very clear that non-judicial punishment or courts-martial may address fraternization or other unlawful or prohibited relationships or conduct. It's very clear that the court system would be used for prohibited relationships. When the manual states that unacceptable relationships would be handled at the lowest level possible, I don't think dragging these issues into a special court-martial, and certainly dragging the issue now before you, is really handling these issues at the lowest level possible.
Counsel, to focus on what's before us now, what might not be before us, are you arguing that the conduct here cannot be prosecuted under the UCMJ, under Article 134, or under a properly drafted Article 92 regulation, or are you arguing that under this case there are specific circumstances under which it is not a custom of the service or otherwise prosecutable under Article 134?
Yes, Your Honor. I would argue that the custom of the service is expressed in the personnel manual.
Would the Coast Guard be prohibited from writing a different manual or engaging in other types of training or taking other actions to establish a custom that would make this conduct subject to prosecution if that was what the service decided to do?
Absolutely not, sir. And in fact, that is actually the best remedy here should the government wish to prosecute these type of cases, is just to revise the manual. And that's actually a fairly easy process. I've helped draft.
We're not asking you to testify as to your own personal experience here.
Yes, sir. But revising the manual is something that the government should do if it wishes to prosecute these cases. And it would be a very simple fix, Your Honor. Pardon me, Your Honor. So unless there are further questions by this court, let me just close with this thought. And that is, the main issue here is jurisdiction. And jurisdiction because the statute is very clear that the government has 72 hours. If you were to allow the government to push forward the substantive issues, the merits of this case forward and review on those issues, then the government would basically have a giant loophole. In fact, Article 62 would be nullified because all the government would have to do in future cases is just file a motion for reconsideration after the deadline has passed and then wait for the judge to make a decision and then appeal 72 hours of that. And, Your Honor, if you feel that this is still somehow a close call between the government and the accused in this case, and if you feel that somehow you're on the line on whether to grant jurisdiction on this issue or not, then I ask you to please dismiss this case. Because the policy position as outlined in the rule analysis, the history of statutory deadlines suggests that government appeals are disfavored, and they should only be exercised judiciously and sparingly. So if it's close, dismiss the appeal for lack of jurisdiction. And unless there are further questions, Your Honor, thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Does the government have rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
Your Honor, just briefly, I want to go back to the jurisdictional question for a moment. One issue that came up is this conflict between reconsideration on the one hand and speedy disposition on the other. This is something that has come before a variety of courts before, in the briefs Healy, Dieter, Ibarra, Smith were cited. And consistently, there's been a recognition that reconsideration or rehearing is an important part of the process and important to judicial economy that withstands the need, recognized need for a speedy resolution of trials.
Counsel, my question is, in Rodriguez, the language that the court divided over was may, whether that was permissive or mandatory. And we took a hard line and said that no, that if an appellant filed outside of that time limit, that their petition would be dismissed as untimely. So why, when Article 62 uses not permissive but may not, and within the 72 hours, wouldn't we be at least as stringent in interpreting the statute?
Yes, Your Honor. A stringent interpretation of the statute is 72 hours to file a notice of appeal.
From an order or ruling of the military judge which terminates the proceedings. So that would be the order or motion or ruling of the military judge which terminates the proceedings.
Yes, Your Honor, but the courts have been clear that that's not a final ruling. And if reconsideration is to be on the table for it to be meaningful for the a party to have to preconceive how reconsideration is going to play out undermines the essence of what reconsideration is about.
So we can undermine the essence of reconsideration, or we can undermine the 72-hour statutory limitation in the statute?
Your Honor, or they can come together, woven together as the system contemplates.
Why doesn't it become a final order after the 72 hours if no appeal has been filed?
Because reconsideration is still on the table. Now, the difference is that reconsideration, at least under RCM 905F, can go until authentication, so that may be a longer period of time.
So what is the purpose, then, of the 72 hours to appeal? What's the purpose of that statute?
The purpose of that statute is to provide for speedy resolution of appeals.
So why, as Judge Erman asked you, when the 72 hours expired, wouldn't that be it?
Because the reconsideration is still on the table within the existing rule. Now, of it's possible that, although as a jurisdictional matter, jurisdiction is met, it's possible that if the government were taking excessive periods of time, the court could use TARDIS authority or some other authority later on to remedy unreasonable
So
delays.
We would make up a rule instead of adopting the clear time limit that's in the statute if we thought you were taking too long, however long that might be in a particular case?
Your Honor, the rules, not to make up any rule, the rules are in RCM 905F apply, and if the government is not proposing a new rule, no, Your Honor. And then finally, just to go back to the substantive question of the custom of the service and what is the role of the manual. The manual is an important piece that is consistent with serially unacceptable relationships being wrongful. But this goes to a question of fact, which underlines the point that to date there's never been any kind of evidentiary hearing to determine whether any kind of notice did actually occur.
Didn't the judge ask the parties if they had anything to submit? And didn't they both say no? We stand on the personnel reg?
Your Honor, the government specifically requested an evidentiary hearing under 904H, and that was denied.
I mean, at the time the petition for the request for reconsideration was filed?
Yes, sir.
Right. I'm talking about earlier.
The exact transcript of the oral argument, I don't have. I'm not sure, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Thank you, counsel. We thank both counsel for your presentations. The case is submitted, and the court will stand in recess pending further order of the court.
The court stands in recess until further order of the court.